from Mythos Media Productions. Your access to myths, truth, and research about the brain. You're listening to Water Cooler Neuroscience.
Hello and welcome to a special episode of Water Cooler Neuroscience, a water cooler one-off, where we bring a guest who isn't part of a normal series, but we're representing their work and contribution to the world of neuroscience in a solo one-off episode. This episode's guest is both a neuroscientist and an entrepreneur. Many neuroscience findings have powerful applications in the world of medicine and brain technologies. But how exactly to translate making a paper and then having a finding to turning that into a product that a company or even a person can buy is very challenging. To be honest, while a neuroscientist receives a lot of training over the course of their PhD, early career researchers don't get any training in how to be a business person and routing prototypes to market. It's just not part of their lives. Because of this, the number of neuroscientists who are long-term successful entrepreneurs is relatively small. And we're bringing you one of those rare examples of a guest who is both a university professor and a company president. Let's introduce our guest.
Dr. Ryan Darcy. I'm a neuroscientist.
And where do you work?
I have a number of positions. I've founded a health technology company called Health Tech Connects. So I'm president and chief science officer for that. I also have full professor and endowed university chairs at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, British Columbia, and University of British Columbia as well.
And as always, let's start with your guest debunking a myth.
I was really thinking about the concept of the myth, and I think central to the myth that the public thinks is we often read about neuroscience advances in the media, and I think the assumption that those make it rapidly, directly into improved healthcare around our brain. And that's definitely one of the areas we focus on, is making sure that we can actually translate some of the advances in neuroscience into improvements. And quite often, if I'm in front of a room of clinicians that are trained in the neurosciences, it's not a controversial statement to say that the level of care for neurology hasn't really changed that much since the 1980s. So it is a bit of a myth that when we discover something in the lab, that gets out into the world and helps people.
Okay, so everybody's seen these headlines on CNN, C-SPAN, the BBC here in the UK, saying we've cured Alzheimer's in rats, or we've managed to move back Parkinson's in 100 patients in this study. These new treatments are being found in labs all around the world. And you're saying that while that's completely true, that they're not false headlines, the chance that you're going to be able to experience this new experimental treatment in a hospital, or that a relative of yours will have this treatment available to them, just isn't going to happen.
I think it needs to happen more. I think that is correct. And often now people are getting used to it. It's not just neuroscience. You hear this in research for cures for cancer that are in mice. And so I think the public doesn't, and even within the neuroscience community, we haven't really got our head around how do we translate more rapidly so these things can help people. That's the area that excites me the most, for sure.
And that stuff you do with Health Tech Connect?
I have an interesting job because while I'm trained and I'm an active neuroscientist, I do a lot of neuroimaging, functional neuroimaging. I tell people often I love to watch the brain in action with multiple tools, so fMRI, magnetoencephalography. We do a lot of work in EEG because it's also portable. And we've moved on not just from imaging, but also to neuromodulation and neurostimulation. So that allows us to really look at the brain in terms of a high-performance engine and advance the way we can evaluate and treat in terms of brain function. And I think that's one of the areas that you can make quick translational differences. So we really try to span from working in the lab and using neuroimaging to actually taking it into a translatable improvement. And that has to actually come from taking it into a commercialized company. So I got to a place where I realized we were able to help people in the lab and we were told to publish papers. And I asked myself, okay, well, publishing papers is great, but how does that turn into something that helps somebody in the world? And when I realized that it wasn't really necessarily going to do that, I sort of joked to myself that It's not as though it goes to out of your paper by osmosis and all of a sudden there's a new advance. And it's not as though a busy clinician has time in their off hours or off the side of their desk to read your paper and make that happen. So I sort of asked the question, well, how does that happen? And it was actually MRI. I started thinking about how did MRI get into the world? And that's when I realized that they get turned into technology products and services. So you have to start to think about how that happens from an innovation point of view. And I got really interested in that. And I love doing that because we take an advance and we validate it and implement it. And then we run it through clinical trials. And then we actually roll it into our clinic. And so people in our clinics can get early access to things that they might not have got otherwise if I just published a paper.
In this interview, we discuss Ryan's background, as is usual on water cooler neuroscience, but given the rarity of finding a professor CEO, so to speak, we're talking a lot more about his blending of careers than a pure discussion of the research, as has been the case on previous series.
In high school, I started getting interested in what I ultimately knew would become neuroscience because I liked both biology and physics. And when I got into university, I was really drawn to the brain, and I was lucky enough to get to work in my undergraduate with a very prominent neuropsychologist in brain injury, Dr. Catherine Mateer. And so she was my first mentor. And I think, as we all know, mentors in a neuroscience career or in any science career are really critical. And she was probably the one that seeded in me the idea that we could use our advanced laboratory findings to help patients immediately. And so I got really interested in that. So I ended up going to graduate school in neuroscience. I'm from Canada, so I moved from British Columbia on the West Coast to the East Coast to Nova Scotia and Halifax, and I went to Dalhousie. And Dalhousie had an embedded neuroscience program, which was really cool. So we were in the medical school, and we trained across all disciplines of neuroscience. And from there, I got trained and interested in neuroimaging in particular. I'd started doing some EEG when I was an undergrad, but I really got interested in both EEG and fMRI. And I actually started functional MRI when it was pretty much new. So it had been originally reported in 1992, and I started looking at and doing functional MRI in about 1996. So this was back in the very early days. And I was fascinated with the whole non-invasive imaging part, that you could watch, you could do these experiments, and just based on fluctuations in your oxyhemoglobin and deoxyhemoglobin, you could actually localize areas of the brain that were doing very, very high functions. So we were doing a lot of clinical research where we would look at neuroimaging data to provide a better evaluation in major brain injury or stroke or otherwise. And I really love the translational part of that. Science is awesome, and you got to love when you're out there and you're pushing and discovering. But when you can see that have an impact on the person sitting in front of you, that's a whole nother level. And we would do work where we would use, derived from EEG, we would collect evoked potentials and event-related potentials.
Which are what for our audience?
So those are when you actually stimulate the brain, record EEG, and then extract the specific response to your stimulus. And you do that through basically averaging, because there are smaller responses embedded in the background EEG. And that what that gets you is your brain's response to a particular stimulus. So it could be something as basic as an auditory tone, or it could be speech. And you can do this visually or in other modalities. What we discovered, which was really interesting, is in cases where somebody had had a major brain injury of any type, could be stroke, motor vehicle accident, cerebral palsy, cardiac arrest with anoxic problems in terms of anoxic encephalopathy, pardon me. What we discovered is that the system would look in terms of clinically, and they were reliant on you providing a behavioral response. So you would give something like the Glasgow Coma Scale, which is effectively a paper and pencil test. And if the person couldn't make the behavioral responses, they were deemed not to be at a high functional status. And if we were measure their brain waves, we could show that they were much higher functional status than they appeared. And so we could actually demonstrate that they would have a high level comprehension when, for instance, they were thought of as being vegetative. And we started that in 1995. And I was immediately hooked with the concept that this had to get out and help people in the world, because there were people who were not being cared for or treated. They were thought they were in vegetative and they were not. And so that was when I really got interested in the translational power of neuroimaging. And my career took an interesting turn. I went from being a hardcore neuroscience environment to taking a job with Canada's National Research Council Institute for Biodiagnostics, which was largely physics and engineering focused on medical technology. So here I was, I found myself surrounded by physicists and engineers, really in the guts of how MRIs were building MRIs, and we were actually building the world's first movable interoperative MRI, which was really cool. And it was kind of great because it was Canada's federal science agency, so we had pretty good sized budgets, and we would get questions from the space agency, such as, could you put an MRI in space? So I thought that was pretty fun. But it was very focused on the concept of innovation and commercialization. So I started a postdoc and was continuing to do functional imaging. That's when my career took a little bit of an unorthodox turn, because we were being asked to develop technology clusters. So things like Silicon Valley, and we all know about technology clusters now, where you build this intersection between science and clinical in our worlds and business, and you actually turn these innovations into real world things. So at the ripe old age of 29, I decided I could probably, we were being asked to go back to the East Coast and build a multi-million dollar technology cluster. And I figured, what the heck, I'll put my hat into the ring on that. And I ended up actually leading that. So over a decade, what I did is I actually installed high field MRIs, high density MEGs, high density EEGs, PETs, SPECs into our largest adult and children hospitals, and translated neuroimaging and neurosurgical, neuroradiological advances into clinical care, and led the development of that.
Can I ask a question about that? Because most of our guests at about the age of 29 were in their first or second postdoc. They were building their name, making a few papers without their PhD supervisor, and becoming independent researchers.
Right.
Here you are, traveling and running a multi-million dollar company. What did you do different? Most postdocs are not making multi-million dollar wages. They are part of the workhorse engine of university research. And here you are, in arguably a kind of glamorous rock star lifestyle for a neuroscientist, running companies, installing machines. Where was the divergence? What led you down that path?
It was funny. I was originally in a high-level postdoc, so it was kind of a combination with NRC of an early faculty career and a postdoc. I used to joke that you had all the benefits of a postdoc, that you just did research, but you were at a sort of assistant professor level. I was feeling not stimulated enough. And so I wanted a bigger challenge. And then I bit this challenge off, partly, I think, jumping into it, not having a full sense of it. And I had a good mentor. So in this case, the head of the Institute was a very renowned, innovative scientist from the physics sphere. And I was pretty hybrid trained by this time. So I'm getting pretty fluent in not just neuroscience, but also sort of the physics of it and the technical aspects. And I leaped and didn't really know, except that I felt that I strongly knew how to do that. And they don't train you how to build technology clusters in graduate school. So I had to learn. And it was a very weird experience, because I was very young looking at the time, and I would walk into these rooms, and I was the guy with all the budgets, the major amounts of money. And I would be telling the head of the hospital, the head of the university, the head of neurosurgery, how this was going to go at a very young age. So it was a very trial by fire, rapid learning experience, of which for sure some things got right, some things you learned on the fly, but it was a unique experience. And basically we succeeded because I only knew one thing, which was get good people. So I focused on hiring a really good young team. And as that team grew and developed, we were quite successful and ended up taking something from not existing, complete scratch, to one of the world-renowned functional MRI and MRI groups that's quite well-known for its translational capabilities. So it was just a wild ride. I can't tell you exactly how, because I'm sure some of it was fluke, but I think it's by finding good mentors and not being afraid to push yourself beyond your comfort levels, to be honest.
Okay, so from a scientific point of view, What were you doing over this period? Because you said that you have full faculty positions as a professor, and they're not easy to get hold of. They require you to have a body of work, normally over decades. So I presume you have that. And what was that body of work? What was all of those studies you did that meant the universities you now work at saw you as a professor, as well as the entrepreneur that you are?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one of the things I realized early on was never drop your productivity in terms of papers and grants. So I did let it sag because a lot of the building and learning on the fly was heavy. So I think I went down in a couple of years to 2 papers a year. And certainly relative to other postdocs who are just in a very, very active lab, my productivity track record in science wouldn't have outcompeted that, but it hung in there. And that was the important part. Because when ultimately that jump, because of my position, I was an associate professor of radiology. So I got a nominal tenure without a major tenure review, which was a little bit weird. But over the decade that I did that, I focused on really making sure that my papers and my grants were successful, and they were pretty successful. So my productivity rates were pretty high, 5+ papers a year on average, I would say. And I got a lot of grant funding because I could leverage a lot. So that concept of leveraging, I could leverage this circumstance to get a fair chunk of grant funding. So around the end of 10-year mark where it was built and it was successful and I was looking for new challenges, there's a little bit of a political backstory there, but I won't go into it because it's a little Canadian history. I decided it was time to come back home to BC, to Vancouver. And when I decided to make that, I was now, instead of 29, I was 39. And I applied for an endowed professorship chair, which was full professor and fully endowed. And because of how I'd succeeded in this very unconventional path, and because I'd kept my productivity in a moderately high level, I was successful in getting that chair. And so I've held that chair since, and I'm coming up on, I think, 10 years now for that. And the interesting part of that is I felt at that point that I was going to change and just go into a full prof sort of mode. I write papers and hang out. But the chair that I ended up taking was involved building a second technology cluster out here in Vancouver. And that's called the Health and Technology District. And we started that. It was going to be a bigger challenge because I didn't have a large amount of federal funding. We had no money. The university gives you really next to no money. They expect you to get it all. So we started working with the hospital and also working with the other universities. And we built up a fairly large technology cluster here in BC, which has spanned into the billions of dollars and multiple high-tech buildings and multiple professors and trainees and companies. And we did that from that one a second time from scratch. And all of it was directed towards the concept that technology advances that we can do can help your health a lot faster. So let's use our technology engines through digital health or through neurotechnologies to make rapid improvements in healthcare.
Tech hubs are known around the world. Facebook, Google, and Apple famously built up some of the first tech hubs in California that went on to be $1 billion and even $1 trillion companies. They wanted to conduct their own research into software and technology, but they wanted also to be theirs. Universities are also known to build tech hubs, but they're considerably different, and I asked Ryan to walk us through the academic version of a tech hub and a neuroscience tech hub at that. Can you give us a virtual tour of one of these technology centers? Give us an idea of what a technology center looks like, because most people, when they imagine one, think of the Google campus or the Apple campus, which are these enormous shiny buildings with primary colors and free muffin bars. What does a neuroscience technology center look like?
Absolutely. So first you've got to imagine, I think for ours at least, I can speak, it has to be anchored off of a large hospital. So at the center of this cluster is going to be a large tertiary care hospital that is seeing lots of patients and has lots of neurologic problems that they need rapid solutions to. And in Canada, we have a public healthcare system. So the problem with healthcare is you can't spend your way out of the increasing resource demand. We spend 50 cents of our tax dollars, with every tax dollar trying to, and it, and it's not working. So right next door to this large hospital, and you can imagine this large hospital has your major universities embedded within it. So in our case, this is University of British Columbia and Simon Fraser University and our cancer center. So those are essential ingredients. You need a location to expand. So you're going to be building buildings. And that was one of the weird parts of my career. I've done a lot of building buildings and building imaging labs and that sort of thing. So we started first by building imaging labs within the hospital that were translational imaging labs. And those included neurotechnology labs that were based with EEG and transcranial magnetic stimulation and that sort of thing. But they were also high performance imaging labs. So 3-Tesla MRIs and 275 channel MEGs and that sort of thing that were embedded. So that's the first secret you'll see, is that the labs are not sitting off in the university. They're embedded right in the action. The next thing you're going to need is space. So right next door, and keeping in mind that clinicians in particular are very busy. So if you're so much as even 100 meters or 200 meters away from them, that's too far. So right across the road, we started building large high-tech buildings, 200,000 square foot buildings, towers. And in them, they would have things like Starbucks, where your busy clinicians would come. So it was part of their space and it was part of the draw to integrate. And in those buildings, first, your clinicians would have clinics there. So they would be working in the hospital, but they would also have their private clinics in these buildings. And then second, you'd create a connection space where people could come together. And some people think about innovation accelerators and or incubators. These were not that so much. They were more about, I've called it like the New York Stock Exchange of health technology innovation. You're really trying to create spaces for businesses, clinicians, and scientists to collide. So that's an essential part. That's the heart of it. You have to have a hub, a technology hub of sorts, where people come together.
And that's a lot more like the normal entrepreneurial hubs that Barclays and universities and angel investors run, where they take seed companies with an idea, which universities and professors are well known for being one of the highest generators of technology companies, because their research just naturally generates technology. And you were providing that kind of space where people can get a bit of seed funding, a bit of advice, and then mostly try and talk about how to turn their very abstract foundational research into a translational product that a company can buy. There's a long way between that. Yeah. So if anybody's curious, you can Google a major hospital, you can Google a university campus that shares its space with a hospital, and Google incubators, business startups, and just imagine them all smushed together.
That's right.
What else do we need in our crazy expensive cake that we're making?
Well, the smushed together part is important. So spatial collisions and proximity is actually the key. In universities, we're very good at generating ideas, but we're also sort of trained to study a problem. We're not necessarily focused on implementing and executing a solution to the problem. So if you look, one thing to look at how innovative is a university, don't look at the number of startup companies they create. Look at the number of startup companies, the ratio of number of startup companies created to the number that succeed. And of course, the valley of death tells us that less than 10% will succeed. And in medical technology, that'll take, well, on average from about, the estimates are 10 to 15 years, but I've heard now the mean is 17 years. So it's a long, hard battle. And that's where the businesses come in. So in these buildings, when you have these CEOs and you have these experienced business leaders, it's really about a partnership, a good, healthy partnership between the scientist and the business person.
And that seems like you'd also need a way to support everybody to be able to live, because over those 17 years, people need to eat, they need to be able to live their lives, have a place to live. If you're not making a functional product that's on the catalogs of hospitals and can't be sold to private healthcare, you're not bringing any profit in really for 17 years. So you've got to have people who know how to keep a company functional over period. And if you are trained in the sciences, it's probably unlikely that at any point you're going to get, as you said, grad training to really know how to keep a business alive for that long, which is normally done with angel investors and supporters and incubators. But that's where you need to have CEOs and scientists colliding so that you have the person making the product and the person who knows how to keep everything going until you have day one sales from a warehouse and shipping.
Yeah, Yeah,
that seems really fundamental and probably something that doesn't become very apparent when a postdoc suddenly has their great idea, we're going to sell this product, and doesn't realize you need 2 decades of support to get to that position.
I think it's also a training humility. It's normal for us in our science training to be very disciplined around what we were trained in and what we weren't. So we're trained as scientists not to go into, I'm trained as a neuroimager. So if somebody asks me a question about neurobiology and biochemistry, I have to say that's not in my area of expertise, right? But when it comes to creating a product, being trained in leadership and management and business, if you recognize that that's not in your area of expertise, then where you're at is building strong multidisciplinary teams with business expertise and otherwise. And that's highly and eminently doable. So I think these areas allow you to build teams that find ways to continue to leverage the science. So you're acting as a researcher, but you're also translating it into a product or service through the business world. And that's what these in essence look like. And they actually can, once you get going and you're highly functional, they can grow quite quickly. We've been able to grow very quickly and increase in capacity based on fundamentally sound science at the core.
This series of Water Cooler Neuroscience is only possible because of you, the listener. So thank you. If you are the kind of listener who wants a bit extra and wants to hear new myths, Today I Learned stories, special members-only episodes, or just want an advert-free experience, please visit our website at watercoolerneuroscience.co.uk and sign up for a membership today. Now, back to the episode.
I've always been much more embedded in the hospital. In fact, in my entire career, I've only been embedded in the hospital. It's differed a little bit from the traditional neuroscience research in the sense that even in our hospital embedded neuroscience departments, if you look down the hall, you had offices of different neuroscientists. They would be different areas. So they might be sensory and someone might be anatomy or whatever. Our teams were very much neuroscientist with a physicist and a computer scientist and an engineer and a psychologist and that sort of thing. And that was, I think, where my research differed in the sense that if you think about it, when you look down your neuroscience hallway, you pretty much think you know what all those people are doing. So you don't really need to talk to them because you think you know. But of course, as you drill down, you'd find out that there's really interesting stuff. If you look down another hallway and you've got a computer scientist or an engineer or a physicist, it's really fun because when you have a neuroscience problem, and one of our fundamental neuroscience problems has been to use functional MRI to discover activation in white matter, which was thought not possible. I could look down the hall and look to my physicist and say, I'm trying to improve the sensitivity to white matter signals. What can I do to the MRI pulse sequence to do that? And so that's the power you always hear about multidisciplinary in your grants and that sort of thing. But I think we define multidisciplinary too narrowly. And true multidisciplinarity means that you know your core, but you become conversant in other people's areas so you can access more powerful scientific findings. So as a researcher, I always maintained a solid base of foundational or fundamental science. And our white matter activation in fMRI has been it. And I did that for 2 reasons. One is, no matter how stressful your career gets, when you need to get some space and rediscover why you love what you do, dive back into research, right? You can go to the gym, you can see a therapist, but if you dive back into science, it's very therapeutic. So I always felt that my foundational and fundamental research was really critical because I felt like I was in discovery mode. And also from a sort of science politics point of view, there still is an error that applied or translational science is not as hard. And so rather than have to get into that debate, I did both. So if somebody said, oh, well, your translational stuff's not that difficult, anyone can do that, I had my fundamental as well. So I really have always enjoyed that. I would say about 25% now today I do that, 75% is translational. And the translational work has always been about taking functional brain imaging and advancing neurologic evaluation in some way, shape, or form. So I've explained how we used EEG and evoked potentials to start to look at functional status in patients. And that's been a big part of what we do. We've actually developed that now into what we call brain vital signs and brain vital sign framework. But we've done a number of translational things. We did pre-surgical mapping with fMRI and MEG. We created the world's first brain surgery simulator, which used neuroimaging data that was patient-specific to do a neurosurgical simulation of a tumor removal on a person before they came into the OR and then safely do it in the OR. And then, of course, I mentioned we've done a lot of work with neuroplasticity monitoring. Instead of doing one fMRI experiment one time, we would do multiple fMRI studies and monitor changes in brain as somebody was recovering from brain injury, the soldier I mentioned, and others, many others, and use the changes in the fMRI to guide the rehabilitation and the treatment. So the key to my translational research is this. We do science just like we were trained to do with one additional requirement. And that's that whatever experiment we do has to also help the person sitting in front. We have to have clear line of sight that our research results will be publishable, but the individual results from the research will also be helpful to the person that is our participant or our patient or our client. And that has been actually on its face, it sounds challenging, and it is, but it's actually where you start to think creatively about how you can make that happen. And the three examples I just mentioned are demonstrations of exactly that.
Okay, I want to ask you a question because I've been to international conferences and heard differing opinions about the role of a neuroscientist in a multidisciplinary department or office. There is one view, which is effectively that the neuroscientist, when you're being trained, should be a one-man band. They should be able to know the psychology and the neuroscience, create the study, then they should know how to make the sequences, they should know how to run the tests, they should know how to analyze it, do all the statistics, and run all of the engineering, troubleshooting, and software programming problems. Effectively meaning that you don't need to have a multidisciplinary because the neuroscientist is trained to handle all those problems. Other countries I've spoken to view that the neuroscientist is there as part of the system, but they should be talking to a statistician to decide how to do the analysis. They should be talking to a physicist to decide how to make the studies and have a lot more people there to help because it's what they were each specifically trained to do. So rather than have one person do everything, you have a team of people do a number of things. I'm curious where you lean on those two schools of thought.
No, I definitely don't lean. I'm strongly in the second. So I feel that one of the key roles of my job is to utilize my neuroscience expertise, but also to be a really strong leader and team builder. And I think that when you build strong teams, I think it's Steve Jobs' expression, always make sure you're not the smartest in the room. So if you build a strong team of people who are far smarter and far better expertise than you, and you help lead that and you help use your neuroscience credibility and expertise to bring your components to that party, I'll put that up against a one-man band any day of the week.
As always, we want to know what our guests are still currently doing because all of our guests on Watercooler Neuroscience are active researchers. Ryan wanted to walk us through some of his stuff that he does in the clinics in creating brain vital signs, which are a very new and interesting way to understand the brain.
Yeah, so my current research is varied at this stage of my career. So it includes, as I've mentioned, the basic and the translational. I think for that example, I'll probably go with the translational and tell you more about the brain vital sign framework.
So what is a brain vital system, actually? Because I'm fascinated by this. I'm not clinical. Vital signs, when we use them, are heart rate, breathing, galvanic skin response. These are so old and known that they're probably in Victorian textbooks. Brain vital signs you see in sci-fi. Somebody puts a couple of things on the side of a temple and 3D holograms of brain images come up, but there's no real 21st century equivalent that's really permeated into mass understanding.
Exactly.
Could you give us an understanding of if you went to a doctor's and they said, we're going to take your brain vital signs, what is that? And what research are you doing on it? Because it's clearly very cutting edge.
Yeah. So start first exactly with what you just said. Imagine the world in the way you just described it. So imagine that when you go to a doctor, in addition to getting your blood pressure, they actually did get a vital sign for your brain function.
And what would that be? Because the brain has so many signals. And
right.
As I have famously once said, I never believe that any signal is noise. It is simply noise to one person doing it on one day. So how do you understand what signals you want from a person and what signals you don't through the enormous amount of information that a brain gives off every few milliseconds by an EEG standpoint? And it is a lot of data.
Right, exactly. And that's how we've historically come at it. Because the first question you might ask is, why isn't there a vital sign for your brain? Why is it that in all the amazing world power of neuroscience, we still, I can stand in front of an audience and I can say, do you know how your brain's doing today? And the answer is no. And that's a massive gap in my mind, right? We haven't created a circumstance to allow us to have the equivalent of blood pressure. And if you step back and you say, well, wait a minute, what was the impact of vital signs like blood pressure or pulse ox or heart rate or temperature or whatever? They were massive in terms of cardiac risk factors, in terms of managing treatments. So if you've got a medication and your blood pressure is going up, that tells you something, right, about the treatment of the medication. And so if you look across the world and you say, wow, cardiac care has gotten a lot better because of fundamental first principle things like vital signs, we probably need to have the courage to at least ask the question of, could there be a vital sign for your brain? And that's a scary question. We got there because we started doing work using EEG and these evoked potentials and realizing that measuring behavior was too subjective and error prone. And you needed an objective physiological measure of how the brain was doing. And then we thought, well, maybe what you do is you would reinvent neuropsychology, and instead of behavioral responses, you'd just use brain responses. But that's complex for a whole host of reasons. And so then we got to the thinking of, well, maybe what you need is to, EEGs are becoming portable, and there are measures like the Glasgow Coma Scale out there, which are, anyone can use them, they can be used quickly, you can communicate the results quickly. Maybe what we can do is try to create an electrified version of the Glasgow Coma Scale. We called it the HCS instead of GCS, the Halifax Consciousness Scanner. And that actually worked, sort of, like anything, right? So it worked in the sense that we could become portable and we could get objective measures of function. The sort of was, it still required expertise. It wasn't fully automated. And that was the point of the aha. What's missing in this equation is something as simple as 120 over 80 for your brain.
Okay, so what were we getting in these early stages? What was the version of the brain vitals that was too complicated?
So there wasn't a version. What it was exactly as you said, we all study complex signals in the brain. And so in a way, you can go back to your myth question or your check your assumptions, but it's inherent, the assumption certainly I had was, the neuroimaging data is far too complex to have a vital sign. And that's the assumption to challenge. Do we know if there's going to be more than one vital sign or multiple vital signs? But at the end of the day, we started saying, hang on, this is actually in a first principles. It's about taking complexity and reducing it to something simple and usable. That's your problem. Can you take the complex signals? They could be any signal that tells you how your brain is doing and reduce it to something as simple as something that it, like 120 over 80 or something to that effect. And that's when we started to realize our task at hand was to reverse engineer a vital sign, take all the data. So we don't reinvent vital signs. We don't discover vital signs. We take all the good work that's been done over the world about understanding how the brain functions and measuring it using tools and figure out a framework to reverse engineer towards a simple number or some vital sign.
Okay, so how's that been done?
Well, we started by looking at blood pressure. We looked at a bunch of things, pulse ox. We were already biased towards EEG for sure. We had used it to date. I've used multiple imaging tools, but the reason why I selected EEG was because we saw that becoming increasingly portable and increasingly more economic. Of course, Canada's one company in Canada has created a Muse, which you can buy on Amazon for about $250. So EEGs were getting out of the lab and they were getting into hands. We also knew that the power of AI and machine learning and signal processing was improving, so we could contain the noise in EEG, which was historically always a challenge. And we also knew that it was a measure that through not only EEG, but also vocal potentials, we're coming up on over 100 years of science and research into that technology. So there was a rich amount of research to extract the signals. So then you had to say, well, where would you start? And we thought probably cognitive processing or information processing was the starting point of what people want to know. So we looked at the major evoked markers that we'd studied through the years. And we started with stimulating in the auditory modality. So you can kind of think of it like a knee-jerk test for your brain, using really, really well-established paradigms. So these are things like the oddball paradigm, where you give a series of tones and every once in a while you have a deviant tone. And it elicits well-known markers like this N100 response for your auditory processing of sensory processing, sensory perceptual, and the P300, which is probably one of the most famous of the ERPs, which is an attention-based measure that comes to deviant tones. So if you sort of call it the aha responses, you know. So if you sort of orient and attend, you get this large P300 response. The third one we looked at was one I'd actually done my PhD a lot on, both the P300 and the N400, is the N400. And that's related to processing, semantic processing. So cognitive, higher level cognitive processing. So the idea was to get from low to medium to high, or from sensation to basic attention to cognitive processing. To get markers, you weren't doing a comprehensive neuropsych exam. You were getting markers that were well studied. And actually, these are very well studied. The youngest is the N400, which was first reported in mid-1980s. So there's lots and lots of science and research. We didn't make them up. The innovation was that when we studied these in the lab, it took hours. And then it took a graduate student or a postdoc analyzing them and putting them into groups and looking at group-related differences. What we needed to do is make them useful at the individual level, make them rapid, and make them automated. And so we created a rapid 5 or 6 minute sequence that got all three of these responses and did so by preserving signal to noise. So that was the first innovation. And then we implemented it at the individual level, used machine learning to show that we could detect these responses in 99 people out of 100. All these things we published, of course. And then we moved on to figure out how to automate them using advanced signal processing methods, and then put it all together and implement it into a push button probe of brain function that evokes these three responses, quantifies the response amplitude and latency. So you got six numbers, can measure that against a normative database or a reference value data set base, can track your own changes over time, so you can get what your responses look like and then find out how they change during treatment, or if you've had a concussion, or if you're losing memory during dementia or otherwise. And ultimately, finally, at the end of all of this, we discovered the answer to what is a brain vital sign, because one of my PhD students plotted it, these six numbers, in a radar plot. And when we plotted these on a radar plot, it formed a hexagon, a nice symmetric large area hexagon. And when we went and looked in people who had concussions, because now, of course, we could go, if somebody had a concussion, let's say in ice hockey, and they were right off the ice, we could actually collect their data, which was the first time in the world, to my knowledge, that had ever been done. And we could see a unique and distinctive change in the shape of this hexagon. So it turns out, instead of brain vital signs, what it looks like, at least the first approximation, being 120 over 80, it's going to be a shape. It's going to be a visual shape of these six parameters from three key responses.
With your brain vital system, if you were a competitor and there was one thing you could make better, what would you make better about it? What's its fault?
When you move from a science to to commercialization, so to make sure this gets out in the world, we have to develop it as a product. So we have this all analyzed because they become friction points, right? And a competitor will analyze the friction points and will try to out-innovate on the friction points. So for sure, one of the major areas, and we just published a paper, is that EEG systems are still clunky. They still require you to put a cap on and put gel in hair. And people who have put product in their hair or don't really want to wear the swab cap or otherwise, that represents a barrier to this. It's a lot easier to put a blood pressure monitor on your arm and away you go. There's no fuss, no muss. So the number one area of innovative improvement is form factor.
And what about from a data point of view?
From a data point of view?
Yeah. So when you're processing the data, what more do you want? What would be a better version to understand the functionality of the brain?
It's funny because I can't. That's going into our competitive landscape. That's the part I can tell you there's a lot of really cool areas that we're working on. I can tell you to stay tuned, but I can't disclose too far along the way we're going.
No, that's fine. That's the nature of translational neuroscience. It has a business.
Except to say this, we are following a model not unlike Elon Musk and Tesla, in the sense that we hope the competitors, we will open source what we're doing. And we hope that all competitors take it on and do their best. Because at the end of the day, our goal is there should be a vital sign for brain function. If we don't invent the best, we hope to have activated the world to come up with what the best is, so that that science is out there and that demand is there. We focus on high quality and we want our product to definitely be in the hunt and in the race. But our goal is back to that major sort of underlying piece of old wisdom in medicine. You can't treat what you can't measure. So in the brain, if you can get a objective, rapid measuring stick for how your brain is doing, the impacts on that in monitoring treatment, in drug trials, think of the Alzheimer's, the drug trials and how they failed with the Alzheimer's drug trials. Their measurement system were things like the paper and pencil testing, like the MoCA, which is the Montreal Cognitive Assessment, or the mini mental status. So you put billions and billions of dollars to detect a subtle difference in improvement in memory, and you used paper and pencil behavioral tests and structural MRIs to determine whether or not it worked, rather than looking at something as subtle as that was sensitive to detecting subtle changes in brain function.
So you may not be able to answer this question either, but is there a version of brain vitals that would use fMRI or MEG or even the OPMs that were developed in Nottingham, which are all considerably easier to have somebody put on them rather than an EEG cap that can be quite laborious?
Did you just say the OPMs were developed in Nottingham?
They were made by Niagara.
Co-developed,
sure, but Matt Brooks.
I think there's a couple American labs that might have an issue with that.
Sure. Matt Brooks won the award for making them, and he's been on the show, so he gets preferential treatment.
Matt's awesome. I love Matt. I think the answer to your question is on the science side, which is definitely 100% open source, and we publish these. We created a framework that any data, be it fMRI or MEG or otherwise, could be implemented within. I haven't rolled out exactly the method to that, but I have it, and it's coming.
Okay, so this isn't unique to EEG. This is something that can take any current form of imaging data and we can start to process what your brain vitals look like in each of the different imaging modalities.
That's right. The idea is to reduce the dimensionality to the essential explanatory variables and regrid that into something that's, instead of complex fMRI image or MEG data, into something that is simple and digestible and useful in the clinic.
And last main question. If you had to have your brain vitals done, which imaging method would you ask it to be done with?
Oh, 1,000% EEG.
And why is that?
Because it's accessible. So when I need my brain vital signs done is not when I can get access to my 3T MRI or my MEG. Those tools have huge power. If you'd asked the question, you have a tumor and you need to get pre-surgical mapping done, the answer is, and I advise this for both, it's both fMRI and MEG. But if I needed my brain vital signs done, there's no question we started with the tool that I would recommend, because I can bring that tool anywhere. We're working right now with the Canadian Space Agency because EEG has been taken into space.
Want to hear something cool? Well, you're in luck. It's time for Today I Learned.
today I learned, and this is definitely not just today, it's been over the course of the last 10 years, but I've really been coming into learning more and more about the potential that you can unleash in neuroplasticity. So when I was training, and I was training clinically with stroke patients, back then, neuroplasticity, from a clinical point of view, was a dirty word. It would create false hope. And what was funny about that is, in the basic neuroscience, we knew for many years about the power of neuroplasticity. And again, there's this disconnect, right? And I have had the privilege to work with a Canadian soldier who in 2006 was attacked in Afghanistan by a 16-year-old kid who drove an axe into the top of his head. And he had very, very severe open traumatic brain injury. And we have been able to utilize all technologies, whether or not it's functional imaging or neurostimulation or otherwise, to really allow him to continue to recover function in spite of such a large brain injury. So today I learned, and every day I learn, about the fact that neuroplasticity sits as an innate biological capability within us all, but I don't think we fully harness it. And one of our clinicians, for example, she's talking about how somebody who experiences chronic pain to a stimulus can actually go to a place where if they see a picture of that stimulus, they feel and experience the chronic pain. And then they can go to a place where if they do imagery and they imagine that stimulus, they can feel and experience chronic pain. And her point was, and this is where I really had a today I learned moment, that neuroplasticity in that case was working, but it was working in a maladaptive way. It was working against us. So I thought that was really cool because it drove home the point that what we really need to do is find ways to properly harness it for positive impacts. Because it's there and it can operate no matter what, and sometimes in negative ways. So how can we better harness that to make brains better?
And the way you're talking about neuroplasticity, many people would just assume that's learning, that you can learn that things hurt you. You can start to associate the pain. We've known in psychology about that kind of conditioning for 100 years, 120 years now, actually. But you're tying this to neuroplasticity, the growth and change of neurons and synapses after, obviously, the very early stages when the brain grows, but in adult life. So is it just that what we think of as learning is so tied to neuroplasticity, you can't really disentangle the two?
Absolutely. I think that's part of the great point, because learning, in my mind, is a form of neuroplasticity. And we've known about learning for, well, the beginning of time, right? It goes all the way back to William James and further, I imagine. So I think that the concept of neuroplasticity, we defined it as neuroscientists in a little bit of a restricted sense. But when you look at the mechanisms, if you go to sort of the Hebbian synapse and neurons that fire together, wire together, these are fundamental mechanisms that show up as learning or as recovery of function after an injury or many other possible ways that we still have yet to fully understand and harness and utilize. We do a lot of work with this really interesting neuromodulation technology called the PONS, this portable neuromodulation stimulator. And it actually is a translingual stimulator. So it stimulates your tongue and goes through your trigeminal and facial nerves. And when you pair that with intensive rehabilitation, we have lots of science rolling down the pipe, ours and others, that is showing that that actually accelerates and facilitates improved functions for neuroplasticity. So you've got to ask yourself, if we can take a condition or a state in the brain that we think is fixed, how do we square that up with the idea that we accept that we can learn at any point in our lives?
You've been listening to Water Cooler Neuroscience, made by Mythos Media Productions, edited by Charles Dyke Productions, with intros, outros, and music by Podcast Polisher.